Hello, this is Professor Leslie Garthotenzer, and this is Law to Fact. In today's episode, Professor Michael Mushlin discusses the foundation for understanding the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. In this episode, Professor Michael Mushlin shares what he identifies as the four myths of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. In other words, what are four beliefs that students studying civil procedure think to be true, but in fact are not true? He debunks each myth, giving students of Civ Pro a deep understanding of the federal rules and an essential background for better success in the course. This episode's a viewer request. We really do listen. If you have a topic you want us to discuss or a professor with whom you'd like us to speak, you can tweet us, email us at lawtofact@gmail.com, or send us a comment through our website. And we always appreciate if you subscribe and rate us on any platform on which you listen. If you're listening to Law to Fact, chances are at some point you'll be taking the bar exam. Well, getting ready for the bar exam means you'll need to choose the study program that's right for you. Kaplan Bar Review will get you ready to take on test day with confidence by offering $100 off live and on-demand bar review with offer code Leslie100. Visit www.kaplanbarreview.com today to sign up. Okay, here's my discussion with Professor Mushlin, where he explains the four myths of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. So it's interesting. I get comments from students, not necessarily PACE students, and a comment from another school asked me if I could do more on the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And I don't know much about it, and I know you know a lot about it. And so I'm wondering, what can you tell students about the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure?
Well, there's really a lot to be said about the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. One of the things about it is that they're not normally... What I'm going to talk about are things that aren't normally talked about in a class in a particular way. It is a source of law.
Okay.
In any civil procedure class taught in the United States, because they're all taught based on what is the procedure in the federal courts, and the procedure is regulated in the federal courts by the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. But they're not all the law that's taught in civil procedure. But there's sort of like the looming presence in the elephant in the room. And the question was such a fascinating question when you told me that someone had asked about it, because it occurs to me that there really are, that students really don't grapple sufficiently with the role of the federal rules in civil procedure. And in thinking about it, actually the question really was really helpful to me, because it got me to thinking about what are the problems that the federal rules pose, and how should students understand these rules. And it occurred to me that there are like four myths that students commonly have about the rules that get in the way of using them appropriately.
That's so interesting, and I don't want to get to the four myths, but, you know, it makes sense that what you're saying makes sense, because on the one hand, as a 1L, because that's when students are first introduced to these rules,
right?
You know, you have certain rules, and you learn those rules.
Right.
But then when you learn doctrinal topics that don't have a rule tied to it, or the rule is not the source of it, it still implicates the courtroom experience.
Right.
Now, I know so little about Federal Rules of Civil Procedure that I can't even say if this is summary judgment or another topic.
Well, they're wonderful rules.
I'll have to learn them. That's my summer job, what I did on my summer vacation. I studied the federal rules. What are the myths that you have?
Well, the first myth I have is that the students know that, I mean, you know that the federal rules are important.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody knows that, but sometimes they make it too important to the exclusion of other important sources of law. And what I call this the cover the waterfront myth.
Okay.
So students think, well, my God, there are these federal rules, and this is civil procedure, and these are the federal rules of procedure. And so that must be everywhere. And they must be definitive everywhere, and they must be dispositive everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is, and this takes a little time to discuss, the fact is that it varies to the extent that the federal rules have significance in a typical civil procedure class. in some parts of the class, it has overwhelming significance. In some parts of the class, it has very little significance. And in some parts of the class, it mixes with other sources of law in ways that are important to understand. So if I can, I'd like to just talk about it.
Yeah, I was going to say,
Okay, I see a civil procedure. I got to get into sort of what is a civil procedure class.
Okay.
I see a civil procedure class as having 8 separate components. And I think most modern civil procedure classes have these components. They're given to the students in various configurations. But I think every class has that.
Okay.
So let me just talk about those, and there are 8 of them.
Okay.
And in 4 of those units of civil procedure, the federal rules are dominant. In 4, the other 4, they're either not that significant, or they are significant in conjunction with other sources of law. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does. That does. That's great. Walk us
through
that.
Let me walk you through it. I think maybe the best way to do it is talk about the 4 units where they are dominant.
Okay.
And then talk about the 4 units where they're not as dominant.
Okay.
So the 4 units in which they are dominant, I have little names for them. So one name, the first unit is what I call getting started. And that's the law relating to pleadings.
Okay.
A complaint, an answer, a motion to dismiss, the beginning of modern litigation. Federal rules there play an enormously important role. The second part I call moving forward. That's after the pleading stage.
All right, so pleadings just get you into the litigation.
And
process.
There are rules that specifically govern this. So it's like Rule 8, Rule 9, Rule 10, Rule 11 deal with this. The second is moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
And in the moving forward stage, that's my term for discovery. It's like after you get over the pleading stage. And Rule 26 through 37 is basically the ball game. And you really get immersed in the federal rules to understand that unit. The third is what I have labeled the main event.
Okay.
And that's determining after pleadings and after discovery, how are you going to dispose of this case? Are you going to dispose of it through summary judgment? Or are you going to dispose of it through a trial? If you're going to dispose of it through a trial, is it going to be a jury trial? Is it going to be a bench trial? The rules have an enormous amount to say about that. Rule 56, et cetera. And the fourth part, the fourth unit in civil procedure where the federal rules play a huge role is what I call the architecture of a case, and that's joinder. How many people can you join in a case? Mm-hmm. How many claims can you have in a case? How many claims can go flying back and forth? If I sue you, can you counterclaim against me? If you sue me, can I bring in a third-party defendant? Can you and I make a class action lawsuit? Ever? So there's lots of rules that govern that. So when you're in that part of the class, it's not wrong to say that the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure cover the waterfront. There are 4 other units.
All right, well, let's finish with this. Let me, I just have an observation. You can tell me if I'm right or wrong. It seems to me that with these 4 units, right, the getting started, moving forward, what was the third one? I forgot the third one.
The main event.
The main event and the architecture.
And the architecture.
Right. They're all about how you play ball, in a way.
Yeah,
Once you're in court.
That's right.
And these are objective, and it seems to me, and again, I don't study civil procedure, that they even the playing field in terms of what you're allowed to do procedurally, not substantively, but procedurally.
Yes.
So they make sure that everyone follows the same rules. It's almost like the blue book, so everyone's reading the same language.
Absolutely.
And they know what to expect from the other side.
Absolutely.
And so it's intuitive to me why these are the ones where the federal rules are dominant, because it's a way of saying, if you want to be in federal court, this is not only what you have to do, but now you can know what to expect from what everyone else is doing because these are the rules to follow. And so it makes sense that when can we most clearly regulate people on what rules that is to follow, but when they're actually going through the steps of litigation. Does that make
sense?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well said.
Well taught.
Well said.
Well taught. All right.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But there are 4 other units.
Okay,
moving on. In a modern civil procedure class where the rules just are not as dominant.
Okay.
One is you've got to find the correct court, the court that has the power to hear the case. term we use is jurisdiction.
Okay.
And there's two types of jurisdiction. One is personal jurisdiction, the other is subject matter jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. So I call these units finding the right court.
Okay.
And for those units, you're really into the United States Constitution, the Due Process Clause. The rules are in there a tiny, tiny bit, but really they are not dominant by any means. So you're really talking about federal statutes, and you're talking about the United States Constitution and the way the founders... It's not like how you play the game once you get in. It's where do you find the court to go.
Right.
And for there, the rules don't really say a whole lot about that. The founders had stuff to say about that. Congress has had stuff to say about that. And so when you're in those units, the federal rules are not covering the waterfront. Now, there are two other units in which a modern civil procedure class has, where the federal rules also don't play a role. And one is that Erie, that I call the House of Erie. You and I have talked about that before.
Yeah.
And the final one is what is the effect of the litigation? Once you have gone through litigation and you have a final judgment, to what extent is that judgment given finality?
Okay.
And that is the doctrines there, res judicata and collateral estoppel.
Mm-hmm.
And those are common law doctrines by and large. Some constitutional flavor in it, but very little about the federal rules of civil procedure. So when students are engaged in studies of those four units...
I think I only have three.
Jurisdiction has two parts.
Okay.
One unit is finding the right court is part one.
Okay.
Is personal jurisdiction, territorial jurisdiction, and part two
subject
matter jurisdiction,
right.
And then there's Erie and collateral estoppel.
Okay.
So it's a myth to say that the federal rules of civil procedure cover the waterfront. They just simply don't. They cover maybe half of the waterfront, half and a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So that's the first myth, and I think that's really not obvious to someone who's just starting the study of civil procedure and starting the study of law.
Well, especially, and I like the way you break it down, is that if you are kind of indoctrinated into it right out of the starting gate,
yes.
It's very, you know, why wouldn't you think that they...
Absolutely.
They prove everything.
Absolutely. You know, and I teach evidence, and actually in evidence are the federal rules of evidence, and they basically do cover the waterfront.
Mm-hmm.
You start on day one with the federal rules of evidence, and you end on the last class with the federal rules of evidence, and in between it's all been the federal rules of evidence.
Right.
So, but not so in civ pro.
Interesting. All right, so myth number two.
So, myth number two is that the rules... The rules are indecipherable. Why even read them? we can't possibly figure them out. They're exceptionally complicated.
Okay.
And this one is just so, you know, it just pains me to see students buy into that myth. Because if you buy into that myth, you don't read them. You don't really look at them.
Oh.
You look at what a court says about them. You worry about what the professor says about them.
Right.
And you don't really go to them.
Right.
And the fact is that these rules have really been very carefully drafted by lawyers, by judges, by law professors. And they are carefully drafted with an eye toward helping the attorney, as you pointed out earlier, who is processing this case.
Mm-hmm.
And they know they want to have a uniform system of procedure throughout the United States, and they know lawyers are going to have to go to these rules when they're in courts, going through those stages, and they want them to be clear as can they possibly can be, and they have done a fabulous job.
Hmm.
I say to students, the federal to try to debunk this myth, the federal rules are your friends, that you really should welcome the opportunity to look. I really mean that.
Yeah.
And I litigated for 15 years, 10 years exclusively in federal court, where I had the federal rules with me, never more than an arm's reach away. And I really did develop a very affectionate relationship with them. So they're clearly... Now, it's not to say that they're not complex at times.
Right.
Because at times, some of the issues that have to be dealt with, like, for example, Rule 15, Amendment of Pleadings, is a complex thing. But the rules do as fine a job on those issues as they do a fine job on those issues. And so students, to debunk that myth, students really need to get in there, get their hands dirty, and read those rules and not just be turned off to right. the notion that I think in some students just feel they can't do it.
Right.
That it's just too hard.
Or, not to play, this is a cynical approach, they don't have to do it. Which,
right.
I think if you read them, then you understand the theory of them, right? And then you are able to better inhale them when you have to deal with them.
Yes.
So.
And so this one is the most frustrating to me because I know that they would do, it would help them.
Right.
I'm not making, a lot of times as a professor, you're making it harder for students because you want them to, you know, you have to.
Right.
But sometimes you're throwing out a lifeline that's going to make it easier, and so you're watching people just not grabbing for something that's going to help them.
Right, right. It's like reading the middle of a book without reading the front and the end.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
No, you're right. That's interesting. That's a great myth. I like that. And so, and one where students can take away and do better.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. Read them.
Read them. We need bumper stickers.
Read them. They're going to help you.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
They will help you.
Right. Heed that advice.
Yes.
All right, myth number three.
Myth number three is that the rules were given at Mount Sinai. You know, these are rules that God gave us.
Mm-hmm.
They're divinely inspired. How can we understand God's will?
Right. Interesting.
And so, what I'm trying to say there with that myth, and that obviously that's not true. The point I'm trying to make with that myth is that the rules are designed to achieve a purpose, and unless you understand what that purpose is, and the purpose is pretty clear, and has varied over time, and I want to talk about that, that unless you understand why these rules are there, it's very difficult to use them. Now, what is the purpose? Let me say this about that. We are, the civil procedure has existed for close to 8 centuries or so, and it's gone through 4 different epochs or eras. The federal rules have been in around, we're on the 80th anniversary of the rules, and over those 80 years, there's been 2 different approaches to the rules, what I call Era 3 and Era 4. And it's really important to understand that because the purpose of the rules has changed over time. Let me just say quickly about that. When the rules were first designed, they were designed with the notion of welcoming litigation, making it as easy as not having process get in the way of substance, allowing courts to get to the merits, making sure that pleadings were just to give notice, mm-hmm. to open up discovery so everybody could share information, discouraging summary judgment so that a case could be disposed of at a trial, having a broad architecture of litigation. We're now in Era 4, and Era 4 is not as receptive to litigation. It's making the pleading stage not just notice pleadings, but a pleading, a plausibility standard. In other words, saying, are you really entitled to be in court? Once you're in court, it's worrying about the cost of discovery, worrying about the burden of discovery, worrying about the proportionality of discovery. So limiting that. With summary judgment, much more receptive to the notion of, well, if there's not anything to try, let's not try it.
What ushers in each of these eras? Is it a change in this court's interpretation of the federal rules, or what?
That's such a great question. What has these changes from from Era 3 to Era 4 came about because of changes to the rules, so that the discovery rules have changed dramatically to say judges need to be much more involved and to impose standards that limit discovery explicitly, but the changes have also occurred through the Supreme Court's interpretation of rules. So what Rule 8 means now,
mm-hmm.
if you and I were talking in 1944, would be very different. The language in Rule 8 is the same today as it was in 1944, but the meaning of those words has changed dramatically Rule 56, the words are the same as they were in 1944. They've changed dramatically. So, and we go through that in class. So that when you're, so the key that here is understanding that the that either through changes to the rules or changes to judicial interpretation of the rules, we're in an era now where the purposes of the rules are seen somewhat differently.
Right.
And if you have an exam, the which you will have,
right.
And if you have a typical exam, if you take the class from me, you're going to have an exam that's probably going to be based on what the law is. If it was an exam now in 2019,
right.
We're in the fourth era in 2019.
Right.
So I'm looking for a student who has read the rules, not that they were divinely inspired, but not that they, these are the rules that existed in 1944. That these are the rules that are now designed with an eye toward a different view of the of access to the courts,
mm-hmm.
a different view of how cases should be processed in courts, a different view of when a litigant is entitled to a trial.
Okay. All right, that makes sense.
Myth four. All right, this is the hardest myth of all.
Okay.
And this one...
Each time you say it's hard, we're building
one,
up.
This one... All right, here's myth four. Let me just read how I wrote it down.
Okay.
When the rules apply.
Okay.
Now we're now in an area where the rules do apply, where we've read the rule.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't been sidelined by myth one. We haven't been sidelined by myth two. We've read the rule. We haven't been sidelined by myth three. We're reading the rule with the purpose in mind of the rule. Myth four is, well, the rule now is going to apply.
Okay. Right. Oh, you mean like it may not apply in some instances?
It may not apply as written because there may be other sources of law that are going to influence you.
So I would say myth four is, the myth is that the rules always apply.
No. That's myth one. Myth one is the rules always apply. They cover the waterfront.
Oh, okay.
Myth two is that the rules can't be, I can't understand them.
Okay.
And myth three is that, this is, I'm interpreting a biblical text.
Got it.
Myth four is, I've surmounted all those problems.
Right.
And the rule, therefore, is going to apply.
Okay.
I've read it. I've had in mind the...
Okay.
It definitely applies here. But that problem, and that is really tough. So in other words, Leslie, you can read... this comes up in joinder. It comes up in a lot of places.
Mm-hmm.
But it comes up most powerfully in joinder.
Okay.
So the rule may say, let's just take Rule 18. Rule 18 says you can bring any... You may. It's not must. You may bring as many claims as you want against a party, right? So that says it's permissive. I don't have to do it, but I can do it if I want to.
Right.
And that's what it says. The problem is there may not be jurisdiction to do it.
Right.
And so even though the rule says you can do it, another source of law, the source of law that comes from that unit that deals with jurisdiction, either subject matter jurisdiction or personal jurisdiction, says you can't do it. Now, students who fall for this myth really get in trouble because they'll read the rule and they'll say, well, the rule said, this rule does apply.
Right.
To this, we're talking about the architecture of litigation. The rule, I've read it. The rule says I can do it. I've read it not as a biblical text, but I've read it
as it applies. Yeah,
and
as
the policy is you can do it, but there's no jurisdiction to do it. And so even though the rule says you can do it, you can't do it. It can get even more complicated. It gets additionally complicated,
right.
where the rule says. Remember what says the rule. I'm using Rule 18. There are other examples you can do of this, but Rule 18 says you may do something.
Mm-hmm.
That means you don't have to.
Right.
You can if you want to. However, res judicata may make it compulsory, or you'll lose it.
Huh.
So I may have two claims against you.
Mm-hmm.
The rule says I can bring one in this case, one in another case, but those two claims may arise out of the same occurrence or transaction. And therefore, if I don't bring them both against you, the one I don't bring, I'll lose.
Wow.
So this is a difficult... This myth is a very alluring myth, and you can't fall for it, because if you do, you're going to lose some points on an exam.
Right.
Because the professor, this is so alluring for an exam. To test on this kind of thing. To see whether students understand that complexity. Now, where it comes from, one is that the rules don't control res judicata. That's common law and collateral estoppel. And two, the rules themselves explicitly say these rules do not provide jurisdiction.
Wow. So I'm on an exam, I get my exam question, right?
Yes.
And the first thing I have to do is see, does this cover the waterfront? Is this, like, absolutely going to govern how we move forward, or is this discretionary is not the right word.
No, it's not the right word.
That's not the right word at all.
No. Is this an area of law to which the rules are applicable?
Right.
Either in whole, the dominantly,
right,
or as one of the sources of law that govern the disposition of this issue.
Right. And then I get through that, and then I have to make sure I've read it carefully, because that's going to help me understand it better to apply it.
Absolutely.
Right? And
that's essential.
Essential. Right. And then I'm not going to take it as written, as handed down from God. I'm going to see how a court or whomever have interpreted
it.
And now I said, okay.
Which plausible interpretation of the rule governing this issue is most in accord with the policies that are governing the application of the rules?
All right. I'm like already exhausted, but okay. We're on mile 15 of this marathon. And now I finally say, all right, I figured out it is mandatory, we're going to say. It has to apply. I figured out what it means because I've read it. I figured out what it's interpreted means. I can't just say I'm home free. Now I have to say, in the context of the question, do I use it? Is that correct or no? I'm not clear on that.
Not quite right.
Okay.
I see what you're saying, but I think in that fourth thing you have to say, well, is there another source of law which may impact how the rule will apply in this or won't apply in this situation. In other words, there might be another source of law that will veto the application of the rule, or there might be another source of law that will influence how that rule gets applied.
Exactly.
In other words, there may be a source of law that tells you you can't do something that the rule says you can do.
Right.
Which will trump the rules.
Right.
There may be another source of law which will tell you the rule has to operate in a particular way that is different than the way the rule says.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, make something that is permissive under the rules mandatory.
Hmm. Okay. All right, so after I've gone through all three, right,
yes,
then I have to now say, is there any other law out there that could influence its application?
Well put.
Okay, good. This is essential stuff. And, you know, it's interesting because we started our discussion with you don't teach this, but you know what?
Yes.
You communicate it. You may not specifically teach it, but you communicate it. But I would say going forward, you should teach it because it's basically, I don't want to say the foundation, but it's kind of the cloud on which the entire course rests. Because if you don't have an understanding of the appropriate relevance and deference to play to rules, then you can't really understand how to use them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense, and I hope people will listen to this.
They do, they will, trust me. They listened to your other one, and I know they're happy to have you back. You were asked by popular demand from someone in Indiana.
Thank you. No, it's hard to put this explicitly in a course because it's something that sort of arises as one studies the topic, but I agree. I'm so happy that the person who asked the question asked it, because it really prompted me to think through this and about how does it, things that are sort of, what's the word, implicit in my thinking, it became more explicit to me.
It's the Socratic method backwards.
Yes.
Thank you so much for taking the time, and I really appreciate it. You are now our official CivPro expert. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you. So that's my discussion with Professor Mushlin. The four myths: that the federal rules cover the waterfront, that the rules are indecipherable, that the rules are divinely inspired, and that the rules don't always apply as written, none of which are true. Once again, a reminder that Kaplan Bar Review is offering you $100 off their live and on-demand bar review program. Just use Leslie100 as your code when you sign on at www.kaplanbarreview.com. Thanks again for listening. And thanks, as always, to www.bensound.com for the music. Again, you can reach us by emailing us at laudefact.com, tweet us at laudefact, or going to our website, www.laudefact.com. Enjoy your day.